This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
You know something, Hulkster? I feel like our backs are against the wall. I feel like we are between the rock and the hard place, brother. I feel like we've been backed into a corner with this thing with Zeus and the Macho Man.
Well, no doubt, Brutus. This is a very tough situation that we're in. But the thing is, it's nice to have an ace up your sleeve, brothers.
Yeah.
Hulkamaniacs, that's exactly what we've got. We've got an ace up our sleeve. Our lovely manager, Miss Elizabeth, she sat down and she gave me and Brutus a history lesson. She taught us all about Zeus, all about Greek mythology, how Zeus was the strongest god in the heaven, and how everybody else fell at his feet, man. Well, Hulkamaniacs, we fell at his feet, but we didn't fall for long, brother. Oh, yeah, we believed in it, man. When Zeus clamped down with a vice grip on Brutus, and I heard the snap, crackle, and pop back in the dressing room, he made a believer out of Brutus. And yeah, when I snuck up behind Zeus, and I drew back with the 24-inch pythons, and I let him have it with a steel chair, Zeus turned. Zeus stalked, and as he laughed, as he was stalking me, he made a believer out of me, too. But our manager, Elizabeth, she cleared this whole situation up for us, man. She sat Brutus and I down, gave us a history lesson, and then the potion, Brutus, that's what made me see clear.
That's right, Hulkster. It was the potion. It was the potion that cleared the way, that gave us the vision to see beyond Zeus, to see beyond the Macho Man, to see the real reality of this whole situation, to get down to the basics, to get back to what we know the best, Hulkster, and that's get the Hulkamaniacs behind us,
yeah.
Get the barbershop in order,
yeah.
Take care of business, and keep one eye out for the lovely Elizabeth.
Well, you know, the way I look at this thing, Brutus, this is just like a deck of cards, man. You stack them all up, and when you knock them down, the rest are gonna fall. It's a team. Me and the barber will function, we'll conquer, we'll divide, and then we'll win. But listen to this, Hulkamaniacs. The Macho Man said from day one he'd be standing behind Zeus, not next to his side. And once we get him right where we want him, we will conquer, divide, and win. But what I gotta say, Brutus, this is our home, man. You guys are stepping into our arena. And in SummerSlam, Brutus, once we get him right where we want him, we're gonna take care of business the Hulkamaniac way, man. We're gonna play by the Hulkamaniac's rules. And when we get done, the Macho Man, Scary Sherry, and Zeus, there'll be nothing left of them except that broom that Scary Sherry rode in on. And with the Clippers watching our back, who knows where Liz is gonna be, man. But what you gonna do when Brutus and the Hulkster run wild on you?
Listening to the what do they call the show? SummerSlam Rewind. Is that what they called it?
Yes.
I'm Parv, and you know, you may have heard me before on podcasts like Where the Big Boys Play or Titans of Wrestling. And I'm
joined by Aaron George. How are you doing, Aaron?
I am super Parv. And yourself?
Very good, as good as I can be at 2 in the morning.
And, that's right.
And what do you actually do for the Nation, Aaron?
Well, I'm a sometime contributor on the main event, and I'm actually participating in a bunch of things on the website. I'm writing reviews for the movies of the PTB generation, and Justin Rosero, Jordan Duncan, and Andrew Flanagan and I have started the Seinfeld Rewatch, which is a really cool article we're doing twice a week, where we're just rewatching Seinfeld and basically talking about nothing. So it's a lot of fun.
Yeah, no, interesting. That first season is a little bit rough around the edges, right? They haven't quite got the
it's still good, but it's not good Seinfeld. And then there's one or two episodes that are pretty rough, very rough.
I think seasons 2 and 3 are pretty underrated when you get to those, but yeah, I've been reading along with those.
Quite yeah, because we get fun. Yeah, they're fun, and you're right about season 2 and 3. Because I remember distinctly in season 2 you get the one with the pony, And in season three, you get the book detective, who was like one of my favorite side characters ever.
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to go off too much of a tangent here, but that one in the Chinese that one in the Chinese restaurant, that's the essence of Seinfeld.
Oh, yeah.
Like, that's a show about nothing, you know. Anyway.
Yeah, and one of my favorite quotes from that is, like, we're living in a society. We're supposed to live in a civilized way. Like, that's the whole show right there.
We're living in a society here. Speaking of which, another member of the Place to Be Nation Society is Andrew Riche. How about that for a segue? How you doing, Andrew?
Don't ever, ever get me confused with civilized people.
I know. Why don't you remind us what you
great.
Do for the nation?
I'm a contributor for writing mainly sports and mainly basketball. Taking a little bit of a sabbatical with the basketball, but I'll be back in the swing of things pretty soon. Main Event, I also contribute. I'm one of the main people on the Main Event, the core four, as they call us. Do some podcasts here and there. I also, like Aaron, I participate in movies of the P2B generation and just some other, I dabble in here and there on some certain contributions and all overall just basically jack of all trades.
But
master of none.
I hear on the grapevine you're kind of a big deal in the sports writing, you know, that your sports writing is highly rated. I'm led to believe by...
Oh, thank you. Thank you. yeah, I try. It's ultra detailed. It's almost like a weakness for me because sometimes when I write it, it takes a while to pound it out. But overall, I am thankful for that.
But we're not here to talk about Seinfeld or sports today. We're here to talk about pro wrestling, SummerSlam 89 in particular. And what we're going to do here, as I like to do on Where the Big Boys Play, and as we did last time on the WrestleMania 4 show in this Rewind series, is I like to have a look at the wrestling observers from around the time. It's always very interesting to see what, you know, Dave Meltzer and the hardcore fans of the period were saying, and it's also a good way to take a look at what was happening behind the scenes. So I've just taken a month's worth. The first newsletter is July the 31st, 1989. And I'm just going to run, you know, through... I picked out some points of interest, and we're just going to have a little chat through these newsletters before we get into the main show. I should say before doing that that... I think SummerSlam's 89 one that people have a lot of affection for. Would you say that's true, guys?
Yeah.
It's
a great fun show. I do. I can't speak for everyone else, but I love it. I think it's fantastic.
It's the first SummerSlam that really got me into SummerSlam as a big deal type of show compared to the other shows.
Yeah, and I was given the choice, you know, that, like, I mean, obviously, I'm old school to the core, you know. I haven't even heard of John Cena, guys. I don't know who he is. Or The Miz or any of your other modern wrestlers. I don't know who they are. But I was like, which old school
good
show?
For you.
Which old school show shall I pick? And is there one called Damian Sandow? I don't know any old new wrestlers.
Not anymore. He doesn't exist as an individual anymore. So
no, he's the local yokel of every show that gets pounded on. So
I thought let's go for 89. That's probably the cherry in the early ones. Anyway, let's get on to the observers then. So July the 31st, and at this point they'd already set up the Zeus angle on the Saturday night's main event taping. But Hogan around this time was legit injured. Did you guys know that? That he was basically injured in the month leading to SummerSlam. And they pulled Hogan from working all of the dates. You know, he wasn't working any of the house shows. And Meltzer actually applauded the way that they dealt with this. You know, it wasn't a serious injury, but they didn't want to risk Hogan getting any more injured, considering the fact he was about to work with Zeus, you know?
Yeah.
So, Hogan needed to, like, be as fresh as possible. So basically what happened is the WWE worked very hard to inform all of the fans ahead of time that Hulk wasn't going to be at any of the shows. They offered full refunds to anyone who wanted one. And this was one reason why Savage was working a program with Brutus Beefcake around this time. So they basically had Beefcake subbing for Hogan around the horn.
That's a step up right there.
Can you imagine being a fan in 1989? Like, you're a little kid. You go to the show WS in town, and they announce, Hulk Hogan's not coming, kids. It's going to be Brutus Beefcake.
Yeah, and your main event is a Warrior Andre match that goes 30 seconds.
Oh yeah, plenty more on the Andre Warrior situation coming up.
Who would you guys rather? Would you rather Beefcake or Hercules? Like in that slot. Because Hercules, you get to hear that trumpet music, right? That's always nice and happy.
Well, they've always offered the refunds. They still do it today in the WWE. If, like, I remember when CM Punk got hurt with his knee, and they offered refunds to people who wanted to go to see CM Punk. Now, I don't know if every fan only wanted to see CM Punk, but it's just a good out for people who don't want to stick around for a show where they finally realize that the top star, is not going to be there. You know, but
no, I actually think it's really good. I mean, in like the wrestling industry, especially of the 80s, this kind of stuff is ahead of the curve. Like, can you imagine? I don't know. Like, I don't think Crockett would have given refunds. I honestly don't.
Oh, if you were a local territory, I don't think you could have afforded a refund. That's why you had to build your roster up and down so that you could get people interested in everything, so that you never felt cheated when you didn't get the same people.
Wow, that's like a smart business model. It's weird.
Yeah, that's why the territories are dead, because they were smart.
Make the whole show good. What a novel idea.
Well, I mean, you know, we've been watching on the Titans of Wrestling, we watch a lot of, you know, we've been watching 70s cards from WF, and I have to say that they're not very good, a lot of them. And, like, literally, so WF has always been like this. It's not just a Vince Jr. thing. If you look at 70s WF card, it's literally Bruno in the main event, and the rest of the card is complete dog shit. And I mean, like, the worst. It's like Killer Kowalski at the age of 50 taking on, like, Victor Rivera. And that's, like, your second. That's, like, your semi-main, you know?
Or, like, so big stars. Big stars, Parv. Those are big stars for that era. Yeah.
It's so, like, AWA bad.
So, no, you're right that the Southern Territories used to load their cards, but maybe they had to a bit more, you know. It's to do with, like, the amount of people in the region, et cetera, et cetera.
Well, it's funny that we're talking about this era, too, because, like, they kind of had at least someone acceptable to step into, like, maybe not necessarily Beefcake, but they could have put Warrior in that slot with Savage, and it would have done, like, it's not that much of a drop-off.
Yeah, they could have used Warrior, but I mean, well, as we'll see, they were pretty committed to this Andre program. Anyway, also around this time, No Holds Barred was still sticking around at the Meltzer calls them the $1 theaters. No, what's a $1 theater?
When I grew up, that was the only theater we had in my town. I had to watch everything second run.
Guys, we still have in Montreal, there's a place called the Dollar Cinema, and it's like movies from, like, you know, like maybe like 2 months after they're in the theater.
Exactly.
The cheapest, like, piece of shit theater you've ever seen in your life. And, like, popcorn is a dollar, but it's like a tiny bag. It's just shit.
Yeah. You just put me in a time machine, because that was my childhood until I was about 12 years old. And then we finally got a first run theater. So, yeah, I would bet that right around this time when SummerSlam was on the pay-per-view channel at my house, I could have driven over and watched No Holds Barred. For the whole week it was there.
These theaters sound really cool to me. I'd love to go to one. I'm imagining Navigator in 1986 or something, you know. Anyway, in the weekend of the July the 16th, the movie had done $195,000 in 285 theaters. Pamelta says that 90%
in current inflation, that's about $52 million opening weekend.
That's really good.
Well, I've got
that's
some.
Odd. That is.
I've got some like Meltzer does give like some basis of comparison here in a moment, but he says of this, so you know, there's about $195,000 of which 90% goes to the cinemas, 10% goes to New Line Cinema. Can you imagine? Do you know what WF's cut of that money would be? Can anybody guess the figure?
If it was less than 5%, that's horrible.
I think it's less than 1%.
Well, Malta says of that 195 grand, they got 6 grand.
That's awful. That's less than 3%, huh?
It's probably less than Hogan got paid this show.
Yeah, I mean, especially given that Vince was the executive producer, they probably get a better cut based on the studio films that they do wholesale now with like The Call and Oculus. I bet they get way better percentage than a fucking movie that they build out a whole cloth like No Holds Barred. That's a rip.
You know, 195 grand is not bad for a late run $1 kind of like past its initial run. It's not bad.
Oh yeah, in 1989, that's not terrible. Like that it's considered like middle of the run, but it's not like a complete, it's not Ishtar, it's not like you reach for the stars and crash to the ground kind of bad. It was a decent budget or a lowly budgeted movie that did pretty low numbers, but didn't, at least you broke even at the end of the day. Yeah, you know,
so I mean, but basically the total gross at that point was 15,588,528. You know, Meltzer, he's very precise in his figures.
Jesus.
I know. But
those $88 with the cocoa, beware.
But basically it caps out about 16 million, which is not bad for a low budget film, but it's not great either. And as a basis of comparison, like Dead Poets Society that year, for example, did 69 million at this point, and then later Meltzer tells us it was 75 million.
Around that time, I think Batman had the highest opening ever, about 48 million in a 3-day opening weekend. That was the summer of the bat.
That's like a failure today, almost 48 million in an
opening
weekend.
Yeah, if you get 48 million a day, it's like, what's wrong with you?
Well, you know, if you adjust it for inflation, you know. Inflation.
I mean,
I don't want to go off too much of a tangent, but the cinemas now in this country, I don't know if they're doing it in the States, they're having like they'll open a film and they'll just preview it for 9-10 days. And then they're like, oh, biggest box office weekend ever. And the weekend's like 10 days long because they've been previewing it and they just haven't opened it in London or whatever. They've been doing that quite a lot recently.
Yeah, and then they'll go the other way and do the global rollout before the domestic rollout. So,
in other news, this past week, Roddy Piper debuted as Gorilla Monsoon's co-host on Primetime. Which was followed by the debut of the new Bobby Heenan show. The first 90 minutes of that primetime drew a 3.5 rating, and the Heenan show, on its own, drew a 3.1, which is actually up from the last half hour of what primetime usually did, because usually there was a drop-off in the last half hour. Meltzer thinks that Piper and Monsoon have zero chemistry. So, a couple of things here. First of all, thoughts on Roddy Piper as an announcer, because I've always hated him.
Yeah, I hate him too. He gets better, but at first it's just distracting. Like you can't follow his thoughts. He's all over the place. He's crazy. He's just a crazed man behind the microphone.
Yeah, a little up and down and out there. He never stays the course when it comes to the story. That's why he was only a really good announcer when Vince was on his ass, like in the back, you know, trying to keep him on track. When he would go on those little tangents, when they would do those little green screen things, that was when Roddy was so crazy you couldn't even understand what he was talking about. He wouldn't even be talking about whatever was coming up in the episode. So I can imagine doing a studio show and watching him trying to interact with others and watching him just go completely off the rails.
Well, and the product is for kids too at this point too. Like I was watching SummerSlam earlier, and he has a promo, and I know it's not his commentary, but like he calls Bobby Heenan a eunuch, that's just gonna go over the heads of everyone. Like all of his references were
Did you see Gene Okerlund's face doing that? He was like,
yes.
He was like a eunuch. And did you notice that Okerlund had his earpiece in? Vince was probably shouting that. Vince was like, he's fired! You know, he's fired!
Are you talking about when in the middle of the show when they were interviewing? Well, that was because that was a scene where they had all the wrestlers basically on the assembly line where they would do an interview with Mean Gene, he'd leave, they'd do the next interview. So he probably
Garvin's
had the earpiece
there there for like 30 seconds.
And just rugged, right? What are you doing in that
suit? So, I mean, I don't know about you. I basically, and I'll just come out right out and say it, I hate Roddy Piper as a babyface. I've always disliked him as a babyface. I mean, he's great. I mean, if you ever watch any old Georgia from 1981, Piper is awesome as a heel there. He's great in Crockett as a heel, and as a babyface, in fact. And he's really good, obviously, in 85, 86 kind of era as a foil for Hogan. I really don't like him after he comes back as a babyface, basically all the way until he... And there's one period where the commentary team is like him, fucking Savage is on there. That is a brutal comment. Have you ever tried to watch shows with those guys?
Late 91, middle of 90.
Yeah.
You mean?
Yeah.
The only good one is when Savage is being attacked by the snake. And they're just losing their minds.
It's really fun Roddy did with the brain, and Roddy's only premise was to get under Bobby's nerves, which would get Heenan to get a really great joke in to try to shut Roddy up. And that was the only time that was ever really fun. With Randy and Roddy, it was so weird. It was like Jock Central. You know, you couldn't half of the jokes you didn't even understand. It's almost like when JBL and Michael Cole are doing their stupid little inside jokes on Raw. And it's like, well, that's really funny between three or four people who actually know what the fuck you're talking about. And that's kind of like what Roddy was doing, would make jokes.
Have you guys ever played that PC game, The Sims, where it's like, you know that kind of talk? That's what Piper and Savage were like. It's like they might as well have not been talking English a lot of the time. Can't really understand what they're saying. Like
the teacher and Charlie Brown.
Yeah, exactly like that, yeah.
And then he'll pull out a word you'd never heard before. Like ham hock. There's a big ham hock.
So the other thing I wanted to mention here is this Bobby Heenan show. Now, have you guys ever watched any of that?
No.
It didn't have as we'll see, it didn't have a very long run. But this was a kind of a novel little thing they tried to do where it was like literally they gave Heenan like a 30-minute kind of like his own show. I think he had like a little nerd on there. I can't remember the guy.
Jameson.
Jameson, yeah.
Yeah.
Jameson basically made his name on the Bobby Heenan show. it's kind of a weird little experiment they did. I guess it was like Vince always had this idea, because I don't know if you've ever seen TNT from 84, 85, where it's basically...
I've seen clips from Tuesday Night Titans, but that's only it.
Well, it's basically a wrestling show without any wrestling on it. And Vince always loved this idea of, like, I'm going to fill up, you know, quite a lot of TV with wrestling people on it with no matches.
Vince has been ashamed of being a wrestling promoter since then.
Well, I mean, he was always trying to do... I mean, he drastically changed the way it was presented, I think. But anyway, that's it for the first newsletter. So August the 7th, Meltzer is full of praise for the way they worked the Zeus angle on the Saturday night's main event, which aired that week. He says it couldn't have come off any better than it did, but, and I quote, Zeus is still an insult to anyone who understands or appreciates anything about
that'll be the last time you will ever hear the words Zeus and praise in the same sentence again.
So do you agree that they at least handled the angle on Saturday Night's main event really well, Rish?
Yeah, I think with what they did for Saturday Night's main event, it made about as much sense as they could possibly make out of it. They a good job at least transitioning over the move No Holds Barred to make people realize that Zeus was the villain in No Holds Barred. You know, a lot of these things where they try to spill over movie-related types and try to put them into the programming, but the message doesn't come across, whereas Zeus was the bad guy in No Holds Barred, and when he came in, it was like the character literally came to life in the ring. So I think it got its point home, to make Zeus this threat. But in terms of, like, talent and in terms of, like, showing what he could do, they did about as much as they could. They did about as well as they could do hiding all the shitty things that Zeus couldn't do and try to at least amplify how big he was, that he could do a bear hug and that he could cross his eyes and look like a psychopath. And they did that about as well as possible. So in terms of the Saturday night's main event leading into SummerSlam, I thought they did a good job of hammering home the point that Zeus was this indestructible bad guy that was coming over from the movie to haunt Hogan.
Aaron?
Yeah, all that. The only thing was weird. I think Andrew touched on is like why is the character from the movie now alive? Like, why? Yeah, like as opposed to the actor. Like, because Hogan's not suddenly Rip, right?
Yeah. Well, it's like Cena looking into the Oculus mirror, and then he wrestles that guy in SummerSlam.
Well, here's the thing. I watched the Countdown show because I'm sad like that, and because I just wanted to, it's interesting to see how they present these things. And Hogan actually cut one promo during that Countdown show, which made everything make sense. It's like the one little detail that was missing. And I'm going to just see in my notes if I can find exactly what he said here. He said, I had problems with this guy during filming. I had problems with him before filming, during filming, and now after filming. He's come over to our domain, and he thinks, you know, where we're superstars, and he thinks that he's a big shot after doing the movie, and now that he's come into wrestling, he thinks he can do anything. And that little promo made the whole Zeus angle made sense.
It does on some level, but is there any mention? Like, remember when The Undertaker was like too into his character, like Mark's too into his character. Was there any of that peppered in at any point? Like, yeah. Tiny is too.
We didn't see the hand from Suburban Fano show up and start haunting Hulk Hogan.
Would it be great if Christopher Lloyd started managing him?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I actually think that they did pretty well working around Zeus's limitations here. But the most amusing thing for me is, before the Saturday Night's Main Event angle on, I think it's like the previous Saturday Night's Main Event, when Hogan's on his way to face Bossman in the cage.
Yeah.
And Zeus is there, and he's like standing there. The most amusing thing to me is Vince on commentary. Look at the size of the monster, Jesse. He's clearly excited. He really put him over. He's a monster.
Oh yeah. And this is a man who's worked with Andre the Giant for like 20 years too.
When it came to promoting on his own, end, oh man, Vince would just go to town.
Yeah, I mean, well, for my money, Vince and Jesse are the best commentary team of this era or any era. Like, for WF, because I don't know. I think Vince is severely underrated as a play-by-play man.
I agree. I can't agree more.
I think early Vince was good. I think the 90s is where I really started to tune out on him. And when Jim Ross came in, oh, thank God. Late 80s, early 80s Vince, when he first took over, I thought he was pretty good.
Well, and you know what's great about Vince and Jesse is that, like, Vince would say more stupid things than Monsoon would, so Jesse could jump on him more and treat him more like shit, which must have felt great for Jesse.
Oh, yeah. I mean, Jesse never pulled any punches, right?
Yeah.
The thing is that Vince is actually, like, three different commentators, right? Because in the 70s, in the early 80s, he has a completely different style, you know? And he's much more like calm, and you know, doesn't shout as much. And then like he has the character that he plays when he's with Jesse, and then he has that kind of like, I guess the one that you were talking about, Andrew, like kind of 94, 95 Vince.
What a maneuver!
Unbelievable.
It's just like I that's just a continuation of 80s Vince, but like he ramps it up to 11, right? He's just like completely lost all scale at that point, and he's commentating on, like, you know, Bigelow versus Dink or whatever it is. You know?
I like to picture it as like a descending mental state. Like, he's calm in the 70s because he's fine. In the 80s, he's starting to crack because Ventura's on his case. And in the 90s, he's just gone. He's just gone. He loves Doink. He's so happy about the Godwins. Like,
yeah. And I even remember in 2009 when Vince and Jesse, because Jesse hosted Raw. And yeah. I remember there was a very short segment where Vince and Jesse did it. And it was so obvious that, like Aaron is saying, that he's kind of deteriorated almost like from a mental standpoint. And I remember when Vince and Jesse were doing the commentary, and it was like, it's like, you know how you have great ideas on paper, and then you see them play out, and you're like, oh, that was not a good idea. This was kind of what Vince and Jesse the commentary in 2009 was like. It was like, oh yes, these guys did back in the late 80s. I loved them when they were doing Superstars and Wrestling Challenge together. And then it actually plays out and you're like, oh no. And that's kind of like Vince. He started to lose it more and more and more as the years go by, and it was obvious that he commentary was not cut out for him anymore.
Well, in fairness, Austin did beat the shit out of him, and that damn DX drove him just crazy.
I always loved it when he would take his earlobe and he would like yank it every time. He would get crazy. It was so weird.
How many lawsuits had Jesse and Vince been involved with, like, combined by 2009? Like, when they were sitting there together?
All of them. All of the lawsuits.
Anyway, moving on then. On that same Saturday Night's main event that Zeus was there, that they worked that Zeus angle, the Brainbusters won the tag titles in a 2 out of 3 falls match against Demolition with some help from Andre. Now, that was in the second fall, Meltzer notes, Demolition were DQ'd for double teaming. And, he says, continuity fans, a couple of years back, on a Saturday Night's main event, the British Bulldogs beat the Hart Foundation in a 2 out of 3 falls match, but didn't win the titles because it was announced that a DQ in any of the three falls means that the titles didn't change hands.
Yeah.
He says, not that consistency means anything in pro wrestling. So,
and that one with the Bulldogs, too, Jesse was so happy. Like, laughing, like, ha-ha, you see, McMahon? Like, it was really great.
So, we'll talk more about the Brainbusters in a little bit. But they won the tag titles. No Holds Barred did another 129,000 over the weekend, so that's another 5 or 6 grand for the WF. Great. apparently, around this time, WF put on an absolutely dire show in Greensboro, which of course is Crockett country. The house only did $15,000. Observer reader Larry Lovell called it the worst show he's seen in over 20 years as a fan. Now get this card. I wrote down this card, okay? The card included Barry Horowitz pinning Ken Shamrock. Ken Shamrock in 1989.
Jobbing to Barry Horowitz.
Yeah. Well, you have to start somewhere.
Oh, my Lord.
Probably somebody will write in and say it wasn't the same Ken Shamrock, but I'm guessing it has to be, right?
It's so much better if we just proceed as though it is.
Tim Horner.
Unless it was like some Irish Belfast type of jobber guy, and they just named him Shamrock. I don't know. That's just weird.
Tim Horner pinned Mega Man Tom McGee.
The Red Mega Rooster, Man.
The series?
The Red Rooster pinned Brooklyn Brawler. Greg Valentine got a win over Brutus Beefcake by forfeit after it was announced that Beefcake basically wasn't there because he was subbing for Hogan at a show in Nashville. Dusty Rhodes beat Ted DiBiase, and the Demolition beat the Powers of Pain. So a pretty ropey card all in all for the WF there. Would you ever like to go to that one? Anyone?
No. I'd rather go to that than the late 90s WCW shows they ran here where like half the roster wasn't there.
Apparently the USA Network hate the new Bobby Heenan show, and they are demanding that it is pulled in the next couple of weeks. Now, Vince is worried about having brought this new show on, and then like, suddenly... Say that again.
Vince is worried. Get out of town.
Well, he basically says he's bought a little bit of time with the network so that he can gracefully make the change. He doesn't want to suddenly pull it after 2 weeks with no explanation. He wants to come up with a reason for it being taken, like an in, like a kayfabe reason for it being taken off. So, so there we go. The plan for September after SummerSlam is for Hogan and Savage to headline the A shows, with Dusty and Bossman on the B shows, which surprises Meltzer that they are putting that much faith in Dusty as a main event draw. And they're going to have on those same B shows Warrior and Andre in the 15-second matches under that. What do you think of that as a as the B show headline? Dusty versus Bossman, 1989.
Yeah. Oh, with Warrior and Andre, it's not bad. Like it's not the best, but it's not horrible. But if it were, if you didn't have Warrior and Andre on there, forget it.
Well, Bossman had gotten a bit of a push from feuding with Hogan, but I don't know if the feud with Hogan made Bossman look enough like a main event guy in order to be the main event of B shows. But then again, I went to a house show where Hacksaw Jim Duggan was in the main event, so you know, nice. That I would actually call that slightly acceptable.
Yeah, and you know all else about Dusty, he was over.
He was a big timer in the South in the NWA. Huge.
But even in WWF, like if you watch, we'll get to it in summer in the pay per view. But he gets a huge pop when he comes out just to fight the Honky Tonk Man, right?
Yeah. Oh yeah, absolutely.
Meltzer does say, and if anyone knows Meltzer, he is massively down on, like, he hates Dusty in the '80s. Like he basically like any dig he can possibly make, he makes it. He basically does admit that Dusty is getting good reactions at shows. But he was like really winding down at this point in his career. Like this is really right at the end for Dusty.
I think it was because he had such a hard on for Flair, and I think even though they worked together for so long, and they've become friends in their years, I think everyone knew that back in the late '80s, Dusty and Flair did not get along, and that Dusty going to the WWF in early 1989, late '88 was a byproduct of Flair pushing him out.
Yeah, and Meltzer does mention at this time that they had a WF had a jobber working at house shows, who was like a Ric Flair lookalike, basically, and they'd have him like jobbing like to the Barry Horowitzes and stuff.
Was it Buddy Landell?
No. It wasn't. It was like I can't remember the name of the guy, but it's basically like somebody who looks a bit like Ric Flair, and they just.
I know. I just figured it out. It's Ken Shamrock.
So, August the 14th, Bobby Heenan, the Bobby Heenan show, much to USA Network's chagrin, did a 3.7 rating this past week, which would make it one of the two or three highest rated shows on cable. So the Bobby Heenan show is like, I don't know, it's outdrawing anything else that was on cable that week. Meltzer wonders whether this might cause USA to change its mind.
Did they have special guest Kirk Cameron or something?
I don't know. I don't know. Like Meltzer basically can't figure out why it pulled such a big rating, but it did.
But like, you know, I get the network because like basically they agree to put on a wrestling show, and then suddenly Vince is producing a Johnny Carson show. Like, did he even run it by them?
I don't know what the deal. I know that USA were pissed from the very get go though.
Yeah,
they didn't like the idea.
Reminds me when Barkley was doing so well with Inside the NBA, and then all of a sudden they gave him a talk show on TNT called Listen Up, and it's kind of infamous because nobody watched it, and it got canceled pretty quickly. That's kind of what this sounds like. They just did a variety show with Bobby Heenan that had absolutely nothing to do with the wrestling that he was famous for being a part of, which is just makes no sense.
It was drawing, though. 3.7, yeah. That's not bad.
Oh, yeah, that's great rating.
It's better than Raw today.
Mm-hmm. Well, there we go. Bobby Heenan show outdraws Raw. Anyway, funny little story now. Former world champion Buddy Rogers, who was 68 in 1989, was at a sandwich shop near his home in Lauderdale-by-the-Sea, Florida, when a 30-year-old guy called Theodore Taroon burst in and started swearing at the waitress. Well, Rogers got up and told Taroon to quiet down, but he didn't, and then started to challenge Rogers. Rogers pushed Taroon back, who then picked up a chair and, and threw it, which hit Rogers on the mouth. Rogers apparently he went nuts and started pounding on Taroon until he cried and begged him to stop, after which Taroon ran out of the restaurant like a bitch. So I thought that was quite an amazing little story about Buddy Rogers there.
And then you know what that man did? He ran right to Dairy Queen and cried until Jim Cornette got there.
So I thought that was quite amusing. Arnold Scarland. You all know Arnold Scarland, former manager of Bob Backlund and of Bruno. Well, he was still in the office at this time, working as a road agent. And in this week, in 1989, he got a little bit of heat with the Nevada Athletic Commission.
Why?
I know. Get this. They ran a show in Las Vegas, which was headlined by Warrior versus Andre. And the match only went 15 seconds. So the state
get out of town.
The state commission was like, "What the fuck? What are you doing?" So, and Scarlan was the representative of the WF there, and he was the one who got into it with them. So apparently, for the Atlanta show, they changed the booking from 15 seconds to 45 seconds, and they almost had a riot at their hands on the box office from fans feeling that they'd been ripped off from a 45-second match. However, the WF is sticking with these very short matches, and they responded, as we've seen, by moving it down the card and giving them another main event. And as we've seen, it's going to be Dusty versus Boss Man. However, Andre versus Warrior was drawing. They drew 87,000 in Hartford, Connecticut. 75,000. This is dollars, not people, by the way. In Chicago. I mean, they're not bad gates at all for their kind of smaller markets. What do you think of these infamous, very short Andre Warrior matches?
They're fine. Isn't that... would we want any more than that for those two?
Well, the idea that Andre... The thing that's funny about it is that, man, Andre the Giant only went 15 seconds. Well, Jesus, what was the longest match he had in the late 80s? Even with Hogan, they never topped at about 8 or 9 minutes. So, you know... To have a match less than a minute, it feels a little bit like a ripoff. With Andre, I mean, really, what else could you have expected? I mean, if you wanted Warrior to go longer with another wrestler, I'm sure you could have done it. But, you know, to have Andre and Warrior do it together, even for a short period of time like that, I think that's still okay, you know, because kids can still expand that 15 seconds into something much more magical in their own mind. So,
yeah, and it builds the Warrior too. Like it does serve a purpose as well.
Mm-hmm.
As I understand it, this was Andre didn't really like Warrior very much, and he was like, "Yeah, I'll put him over, but I'll only do it if I work it under a minute." So I think he was basically like, because he was in a lot of pain at this time, and he didn't really like the idea of putting Warrior over anyway. So like that was his condition. So that's. They were kind of between a rock and a hard place.
But it's kind of a funny thing on that because, like, it's like guys – like I've heard interviews where Bobby Heenan will say, like, yeah, Andre hated him. And then I'll hear other interviews where Warrior himself would be like, no, we were fine. Now they're probably not both good sources, but I'm sure the truth is somewhere in the middle on it. I like to think so anyway.
Yeah, well, who knows? I'd be inclined to believe Heenan over Warrior. Just saying. I'd just be inclined to believe
After all the cheating you saw him do, you'd be inclined to believe Bobby the Brain Heenan.
Well, I'm a lifelong heel fan. So maybe. Anyway, August the 21st, there's not a lot of news in this one at all. In fact, all that really happens in this newsletter is that Meltzer continually puts in sly digs on Dusty. He reckons that Dusty looks like a Japanese female wrestler called Dump. Matsumoto. If you look up Dump Matsumoto, she's basically a fat Japanese wrestler with dyed blonde hair.
Like Bull Nakata.
Yes, but like fatter and blonder, basically. But yeah, in fact, I think she was even an opponent for Bull at some point. And Meltzer basically, like, this gives him the opportunity to say that, you know, Dusty's just like her, only she's a much better worker than he is. So,
come on!
He's just like, he's really like...
Jesus. Meltzer, that's just clear. That's just clear trolling. That's just a troll job. I'm sorry, but it just sounds like it to me. It's like the love affair he had with, who was that, there was this one guy that he just I think the one team that he just loved was the Fantastics. I remember it's not that the Fantastics were a mediocre tag team that was overrated, but it was always like every match the Fantastics had got like 4 stars, or I think he gave a perfect rating to this one he had with the Sheepherders, which it is a really good match, no doubt. But it seems like when he loves something, he goes over the moon for it. You know, All Japan, New Japan, he did that with certain wrestlers. And for him to
Dynamite Kid and Tiger Mask would be the ones, like, he really pimped the shit out of them. Current New Japan, he absolutely loves. You know, you can tell when Meltzer has a hard-on for someone, because he pimps them.
Exactly, exactly.
Whatever the reverse of a hard-on is, he's got that for Dusty. So
it happened with Samoa Joe. Like, he just – every match with Samoa Joe that was even, like, remotely good, he overrated. Even the matches at Ring of Honor. And some of those matches are great, no doubt. But for him to give perfect ratings to some of those matches, it still makes me wonder, you know. But he does that a lot. And for him to – I don't even like Dusty Rhodes that much as a wrestler. In fact, I think he was kind of an average wrestler, but for him to just completely shit on him is a little bit disingenuous.
Yeah, well, no, it's an ongoing thing. He doesn't stop doing it. He's still, I'm reading the ones from 1991 for Where the Big Boys Play, and every week, I mean, Dusty's the booker. He'll just bury him whenever. Like, during a Dustin Rhodes match, like, he's got... He doesn't like Dusty. I think he blames him for putting Crockett out of business, basically. Anyway, August the 28th, and Jake Roberts is in hot water and has been sentenced with assault charges stemming from an incident last September. I'm not actually sure what that incident is. Do you guys know at all?
I don't know anything about it.
But
He was only mentioned once on the SummerSlam pay-per-view, and that was when Ted DiBiase mentioned him in an interview segment, and that was it.
Let's imagine that he DDT'd a priest.
but basically, he's had like some suspended sentence for a month, and the WF are already advertising a program of return matches with DiBiase in October around the horn. They're pretty sure that Jake is not going to jail, basically. And they'd written him out of storylines during this time. They had DiBiase give him the $1 million dream, and apparently like injured his neck or something, which is why Ted briefly referred to he calls himself the man who put Jake Roberts out of wrestling. That's what they were referring to. And of course that angle wouldn't blow off until WrestleMania, right? WrestleMania 5. So that was a slow burn angle.
It was a slow burn match too at WrestleMania 5.
Yeah.
You know, yeah, I mean, that's one of those feuds where the promos are much better than the matches. especially Jake's promos in that.
It's the first time I've ever seen a match where the crowd's starting doing the wave.
So, Andre, speaking of the wave, I didn't find out until recently that in the US and Canada, they call it the wave, but here we call it the Mexican wave. Because I was like with a Canadian friend, I was like, yeah, they're doing a Mexican wave. She was like, you can't say that. It's racist. I was like, no, it's called the Mexican wave. What are you on about? He was like, no, it's called the wave. I was like, what? Do you guys know about that?
We know about England being racist. We know.
they first started doing it during the Mexico World Cup in 1986. So everyone called it the Mexican wave, you know? Anyway.
It's like when you call Ultimate Warrior and you say Dingo Warrior. You say, hey now. It's like, no. He was called the Dingo Warrior.
Yeah.
Do you know what Meltzer calls him consistently?
It's bad. It's got to be bad, right?
he calls him the Anabolic Warrior. And his other big one is the Junk Food Dog, of course. He loves – those are his special names, Anabolic Warrior, Junk Food Dog.
How much per month are you paying for those puns? Because –
Well, I mean, he kept them going for years. And he's, like, consistent. He'll never call him Ultimate. He's always Anabolic. Anyway, another wrestler who's in hot water, speaking of Warrior, is Andre. He was arrested following an incident in Cedar Rapids. Andre was charged with assault and criminal mischief when he accosted a KCRG cameraman called Ben Hildebrand after his 30-second main event with the Anabolic Warrior. According to one report, Andre shook the cameraman, gave him a few bruises, knocking his back out of whack and doing about $300 worth of damages to the camera. Andre thought that he was filming the match with Warrior, and he didn't want it to be seen anywhere, basically. apparently, Hildebrand had been told not to film the match by Tyson, but the film crowd, but he was basically there to film like crowd reactions, not the match itself. But Andre didn't know that and beat the shit out of him, basically. So that's like suggests that Andre did not want these matches being seen or talked about by anybody who wasn't there.
Tim White must have been drunk that night because he would have definitely not let that happen.
I don't like this one as much because there's too many details, so I can't imagine a better scenario. Like, I was hoping you'd say, like, I didn't know, so we could be like, oh, Andre was like, well, let's imagine he ate a dog and a cat from someone's lawn or something.
Well, yeah, that name Ben Hildebrand is familiar to me for some reason, but I don't know.
Because
well,
Brian Hildebrand is a ref, right?
Yeah, that's right. Brian Hildebrand's the ref.
It can't be the same person, though. There's no possible way.
Yeah, maybe connect. I mean, wrestling's not that bigger.
Yeah, well, his referee name was Mark Curtis, but he was beloved by the WCW undercarders and by his real name, Brian Hildebrand, so.
Yeah. That's a gig, isn't it? Like lower card referee.
Well, unless you drive around the boys and you become tight with them, that's what happened to him. You know, a lot of these other guys, like Tim White. I just talked about Tim White. Tim White was he's one of the referees on the SummerSlam pay per view, and he coincidentally does the Andre match for the 6-man tag because he was very very tight with Andre. It was kind of his job to kind of drive Andre around and do everything he possibly could to make life as comfortable as possible for him before you know things got worse for him. But yeah, some of these referees, they become really really close. You know, Joey Morella was very close with a lot of those people before he died. So
yeah. Okay, I remember there's a clear pecking order in the referee ranks. Like Earl Hebner is obviously like head honcho in you know, around this time. And I do think he, like, fiercely guarded his top referee slot, you know, like...
He held everyone else down.
Which referee again?
Earl Hebner.
Earl Hebner? Yeah, he was the up-and-comer. I thought the top guy, to me, was Morella. I thought he was the top referee for a little while. And then I guess he got a little bored with it in the early 90s. He stopped doing it as much. And Earl became the guy.
Doesn't Hebner ref the main event here?
Yep.
I think basically the evil twin referee angle made Hebner into like a, you know, a big deal. Over in WCW land, it would have been Nick Patrick.
Tommy Young was the man.
Tommy Young, and then Tommy Young gets injured, or he's ill or something, and then Nick Patrick becomes the main referee.
Him and Randy Pee Wee Anderson.
Randy, don't call me Pee Wee Anderson.
Patrick had the worst count of any referee ever, though.
Yeah, he did the little like the twirl. Like he would bring it up and he'd go one, twirl, two. And the other one I hated, and I was watching the SummerSlam show and I saw it was Morella. Morella would do the like it was almost like somebody was like doing whack-a-mole. Like you have to have the hand really close. And he would go one, two. It was like that was the more annoying one to me. Tommy was great because I think Tommy was the guy that, for example, Charles Robinson patterned himself after. He would do the long winded count like that, like perfectly. Yeah. You know, like when I watched Charles Robinson, Little Nate, he did it perfectly. Like if you need to do a perfect referee performance, watch Charles Robinson. You know, but Nick Patrick, yes, he had a little theatricality to it.
And how long do you think it would take people to turn off the podcast if we just talked about referees?
Yeah, about referees.
Well, I'm gonna really crank it up now. I'm gonna start talking about WF referees.
Keep going
in the 70s.
Like two minutes.
Dick Worley and Dick Kroll. If you want to see bad count, literally every ref in WF in the 70s does a fast count every single time. One, two, three. Like it's ridiculous.
Yeah.
And they're biased towards the faces too. So it's like there's no rhyme or reason for it.
Is one of those guys the guy who had the bowl cut in the early 80s of WWF too? Remember that guy?
Bowl cut,
little mustache.
Is that Scrappy McGowan? No, I think Scrappy McGowan's a WCW ref. Anyway, let's move on. We talked about
Yeah, we got to get away from this.
In other news, Jesse Ventura is about to start commentating for the Tampa Bay Buccaneers next season. Anything that you know about Andrew Ventura's kind of sideline as a
No, I didn't know about him doing the Buccaneers. They were still the Yucks by then. They never even got even. They had one good year in the late 70s, but the entire 80s and the early 90s, they were dog shit. So I can't imagine what the hell he actually had to talk about. Maybe the beautiful interceptions thrown by Vinny Testaverde. I can't think of anything else. But I did watch him do color commentary in the XFL, where one of his main things is that he had a feud with, like, the head coach of the team or somebody like that.
Was his name Rusty Tillman, the coach? Is that it?
I don't know. I don't even know a lot of the coaches that were in the XFL except for Jerry DiNardo. And the only reason I even knew that is because he was an LSU coach who went to the XFL right after that. I think he was in the XFL. The XFL is such an eyesore. You don't even want to remember any of it. But no, Jesse with Tampa Bay, I don't remember anything like that.
Could you imagine the play by play guy in Tampa Bay just being berated by this man?
Vinny Testaverde threw that interception.
I can guarantee that Jesse made it much more watchable, though. I'd have loved to be a Tampa Bay fan around that time. Like,
no, you do not want to be a Tampa Bay fan. Take that back.
But, like, just to have Jesse on the commentary, he surely makes anything instantly more watchable, right? Like,
not the Tampa Bay Buccaneers.
The Bobby Heenan show has been dropped.
So
there we go. What did they get? A 4-week run. And get this. So we talked earlier about Ken Patera being jobbing to Barry Horowitz. Guess who else is coming in? Steve Blackman.
Yes.
Steve Blackman is coming in. This is 1989. So, it's kind of strange to see these names I associate with the Attitude Era here in 1989.
Well, there was no mixed martial arts then, so I don't know, maybe they were trying to get into the kickboxing game and they just wanted to try wrestling out before they went into kickboxing and eventually mixed martial arts. It's the only thing I can think of.
And the final news story in this batch of Meltzers is that the gates have generally been down over the summer. Savage versus Hogan has been failing to sell out even mid-sized markets. For example, the August the 19th Philly card was only 12,145, and the Spectrum can hold 20,000. And I mean, Bruno would sell that out every single month. So it's interesting to think that, you know, at the height of Hulkamania here in 1989, they weren't selling out every card, even with Hogan versus Savage on top. Any thoughts on that?
Well, I mean, they kind of ran it into the ground at that point too, right? And had beaten Savage in basically every conceivable way. So where's the drama now?
Yeah, I mean, 5 elbow drops will do that. 5 elbow drops and a kick out will do that to a feud, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's one thing that you could criticize with Vince's kind of booking of heels in general. Is that once they have their run with Hogan, they're kind of like, where else is there for a heel to go, you know?
Sorry, go on.
Well, you were talking about Boss Man, for example. Like, he's kind of tainted now because he's already been beaten around the hall by Hogan.
Yeah, of course. And not only did Hogan beat Savage, he took his woman, too.
Yeah, well, I mean, I don't know if we want to get into it. Let's talk about that later, because I have strong views on that as well, as does Jesse, obviously.
What's up, everybody? This is Kevin Kelly from Ring of Honor Wrestling. Make sure you check out the Kevin Kelly Show each and every week. We'll be talking about wrestling in the past and wrestling today, plus be talking about all kinds of sports and pop culture, whatever's on your mind, too. We'll answer your questions each and every week. The Kevin Kelly Show, right here. PlaceToBeNation.com.
This is the king of old school, Steve Corino, and you've heard all the rumors, and it's true. The Steve Corino Show is here. We talk about wrestling, we talk about baseball, movies, television, anything you want to talk about. New guest every week. That's right, the Steve Corino Show every week here on the Place to Be Nation.
Hey, this is Bauer from The Bauer Show, sports and more. You can check out The Bauer Show podcast
every Wednesday and Friday right here at placetobenation.com.
The Bauer Show.
Chad, do you hate it when commercials run and run?
What do you mean, Parv?
Oh, never mind.
Listen to Where the Big Boys Play on placetobenation.com and find us on iTunes. We are the only WCW Supercard exclusive podcast.
Greetings, friends. Ben Morse from Place to Be Nation's Main Event here. Tired of other podcasts constantly stuck in the past? Every other week, we give you a roundtable discussion of what's happening in wrestling today. Place to Be Nation's Main Event. We're holding everybody else down.
Looking for something different in your pro wrestling podcast? Look no further than the Pro Wrestling Super Show. Join me, Stephen Graham, every week as I'm joined by a rotating door of guests as we discuss a single topic each show, ranging from ECW pay-per-view reviews, wrestler snapshots, top six lists, and anything else you can think of. That's the Pro Wrestling Super Show every week here on the Place to Be Nation.
So you got the script, yeah? You all got it?
Yeah.
Oh, that sounds terrible. The Titans of Wrestling... Oh, brilliant. Sorry. The Titans of Wrestling are...
Pete, I'm a lead analyst for the show and breakdown matches.
Kelly, lead historian. I'm a jobber lover. Are you?
Johnny and I drink.
And yes, me, Pop. We watch old school wrestling and love it.
Titans of Wrestling.
You know you want to hear it.
What's going on? This is the Godfather, Nate Milton, with an offer you cannot refuse. Each and every week you can join Marcus Vanderberg, Big Nasty Alfred Kunawa, and myself on the Kings of Sport podcast, available exclusively on placetobenation.com, your one-stop spot for the best in sports and pop culture.
Hey, sports fans, this is Dr. G for Extra Point, Place to Be Nation's traditional sports talk podcast. Every episode, Scott Criscullo and I talk everything from the Big Four leagues to all the hot sports news with exclusive guests and analysts. Email us your comments and questions at extrapoint@placetobenation.com. That's the Extra Point, exclusively on placetobenation.com.
Hey, sports fans, Cowboy here. Make sure you make your weekly stop by the Sports Lounge here on placetobenation.com, where the boys and I tackle all the hot topics in the world of sports. We go behind the numbers and provide in-depth expert analysis on Major League Baseball, MMA, NFL, and more. The seats fill up quick, so grab your favorite cigar, kick back, and join us in the Sports Lounge, only on placetobenation.com.
In Rhode Island, and looking for great food and a fun atmosphere, we'll be sure to stop by Bonehead's Wing Bar, 131 Washington Street in West Warwick, with over 65 different wing sauces and dozens of sandwiches, burgers, and appetizers. In a fully stocked bar, Bonehead's has something for everyone. Boneheads also shows every WWE and UFC pay-per-view, features live music, weekly trivia, and much, much more. So, be sure to stop in, tell Matt and the crew that Place to Be Nation sent you, and become a Bonehead today.
Hey, this is Rob Naylor. Do you still enjoy pro wrestling? Believe it or not, I still do. So you better join myself and Will on the Google Wrestling Podcast, exclusively at PlaceToBeNation.com.
Shit, I wasn't ready. Hey, this is Will. If you like listening and shit. Hey, this is Will. If you like listening to guys talk about old school wrestling, follow me and Charles on Wrestling with the Past podcast on Place to Be Nation.
On Richard and the Mailman, we talk about life with great enthusiasm, which eventually leads to disillusionment and inevitably hopelessness. But don't worry, there's lots of laughs along the way. So check us out every week or month or whatever on Richer and the Mailman.
What's up, wrestling fans? This is Jeff Peck, and you can check out my wrestling podcast, The Still Real to Us Show, every Saturday right here at placetobenation.com. It is a wrestling podcast from a fan's perspective, and we're not doing it in our mom's basement. So check it out every Saturday right here at placetobenation.com.
It's still real to me, damn it!
Looking for new wrestling, sports, and pop culture voices? Head over to placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world. We have an extremely talented staff that covers comics, video games, and all facets of entertainment. Our sports coverage spans all the major professional and collegiate sports, including MMA. Our fresh takes on professional wrestling are some of the best on the internet. Also, be sure to check out our friends at thehistoryofwwe.com, prowrestlingonly.com, Scott Keith blog at rspwfaq.net, and piledriverwrestling.net.
Hey there, Nation. This show's going pretty long, so what we're going to do here is break this into two parts for you. If you're on placetobenation.com, you can go ahead and click the link right in this very post. If you're listening on iTunes, part two will start right now.